visiting our daughter who lives in Jerusalem, but we were with you in Woodside from 98 to 2000.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hi, it's Borensons, right?
Yeah.
Hi, how are you? Good. That took me a while to a second.
Well, that's very good.
That how are you? Good to
very
see
good.
You.
Very good.
Welcome.
How's your family? How's your wife?
Thank God. Thank God. Our son is in Baltimore, so he didn't come with us, but she's doing well. Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's good to see you. So you say you have children in Jerusalem?
Well, we have one in Haifa and family, and one here in Jerusalem.
Uh-huh. Very nice.
Just made out. Yeah.
So they're all here?
No.
Oh, you have some.
One in Cleveland and one in Palo Alto.
Oh, so you're equally balanced.
That's almost true.
I am, yeah, two.
It's
yeah, two girls here. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thursday. We saw Sally yesterday.
Right, you mentioned it on the bus.
Yeah. How are you?
Yeah, thank God.
We smell you all the time, the girls. I think yesterday was there for Shabbos. Well, we were here yesterday.
Very good. Very good. Yossi is still in school? He has his degree already. Does Yossi have his degree already? Or?
No, he's one more year. He has to do a year of externship and a facility in Georgia. And then hopefully he has to write a paper and then we'll show next summer, next year. We're waiting. How are you?
Good, good. So you're both people of leisure? You're both retired?
Yes, we're very busy, but we're of leisure. Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Do you have time after this to talk a little bit?
You know, a few minutes. Just unfortunately, I got to go. You know, Tuesdays and Wednesday are crazy days. I'm here and then I got to go back. But we can talk a few minutes. We can get some time. Okay. Maybe the only one.
Yeah, that's why we came for sure.
Yeah, okay. So where are you staying?
Oh,
this was for the
Azkar.
This was for the Azkar. Yeah.
I'll come and say right.
I hope she's doing well. Okay. And how is their daughter? Where is she?
She was there.
Okay. So she came in also? She was there?
She said you came. Remember seeing you last time. She said you came. It was very nice.
No, good.
It was very touching.
No, it was a very sad time. Yeah.
59. It's very hard.
Okay. All right, hi everybody. First, I want to wish everyone a happy Purim Katan, and I'll tell you, as a bit of a digression, I'll tell you a very interesting pilpul thought from Rav Yonasan Eibshitz. You know, Rav Yonasan Eibshitz was very, very famous, Rav of Prague. He was nothing that I'm going to talk about, but he was embroiled in a great, great controversy with Rav Yaakov Emden. This was shortly after the Shabtai Tzvi, false messianic campaign, and Rav Yaakov Emden, who tended to be a very, very zealous person, accused Rav Yonasan Eibshitz, who was a Kabbalist as well, of being a closet follower of Shabtai Tzvi, and this was a controversy that literally tore Europe apart, in which one gadol was accusing another gadol of very bad behavior. Things don't change, actually. We have that, now that I think about it, those things happen even today. But this was a very, very serious accusation. And in fact, the Vilna Gaon, who was just a young man at the time, this is what made the Vilna Gaon famous initially, that the Vilna Gaon, as a man of 29 or 30, was very involved in trying to make shalom between the two sides. Interestingly, without getting into that controversy too much, because that's really the whole board I want to tell you is a digression. This is a digression on the digression. Interestingly enough, some historians actually say that Rav Yonasan Eibshitz may have been initially a follower of Shabtai Tzvi, and there's really nothing wrong with that. In other words, there were people who honestly thought initially, just like Rabbi Akiva thought Bar Kokhba was Mashiach, there could have been Sadiqim and Gedolim who also initially thought Shabtai Tzvi was Mashiach. That doesn't automatically taint a person because he had that belief. And there's another very interesting speculation, although this is a bit also controversial, that what Rav Yaakov Emden really was angry about was what he perceived as a slight by Rav Yonasan Eibshitz against Rav Yaakov Emden's father, the Chacham Tzvi. Because there was an issue of kashrus. The issue was, what was the issue? The issue was a famous case in the annals of halacha in which a chicken was shechted, and when they examined the chicken, they couldn't find the heart. There seemed to be no heart in the chicken. Now normally, if you're missing an internal organ, that would make the animal a treifa. But Rav Yaakov, the Chacham Tzvi ruled that since it's impossible for the animal to live at all without a heart, there must have been a heart, and the heart was lost. A cat took it or something like that. Therefore, he said, theoretically, if you shecht an animal and you don't find a heart, it is kosher because you assume the heart was there. Rav Yonasan Eibshitz argued with the Chacham Tzvi, and he actually tied it, perhaps there was some malformed organ that took the pumping function of the heart. And since it's not a heart, so to speak, therefore it would be treifa. And he argued with the Chacham Tzvi in some very sharp language. So some suggest that Rav Yaakov Emden was out to get him. to avenge the glory of his father. But be it as it may, Rabbeinu Sneifetz is one of the great, great Gaonim. And, but not only was he a great Gaon in Halacha, the Urim V'Tumim, etc., but he also wrote a Sefer of Drush, a Sefer of homiletical comments that is called Yaros Devash. And the Drush is very complicated, so it's not necessarily the most popular Sefer today because it's very, very involved and complicated, but it is considered to be one of the classic Sifrei Drush that we have in Klal Yisrael. It is not organized on the Seder of the Parshios, but on the Seder of various dates. So it'll be Shabbos HaGadol Drushos, there'll be Shabbos Tshuva Drushos, there'll be Drushos for Zion Adar, there will be Hespedim for various Gedolim, there will be Chanukah Drushos, things like that. That's what it is. So he has many, many Drushos on Purim and Adar. So this is what he says. He says a very, very interesting thing. And I actually want to contrast this with the famous word of the Vilna Gaon. You know that Parshas Tetzaveh, which is the Parsha that we just read on Shabbos, is, as I'm sure you know and you've heard, the only Parsha from the time that Moshe Rabbeinu is born in Parsha Shmos that Moshe Rabbeinu's name is not mentioned. Moshe Rabbeinu's name does not appear in Parshas Tetzaveh. And Chazal already pointed out that Moshe Rabbeinu at the Chet HaEgel asked that if you don't forgive the Jewish people, Mecheni na misifrecha asher kasafta, erase me from your book. And even though Moshe Rabbeinu said that only if Hashem doesn't forgive, and Hashem did forgive, but the Gemara says when a tzaddik issues a curse, even against himself, even if it's conditional, it's going to happen. So Moshe had to be erased from some parsha. So he was erased from Parshas Tetzaveh. Now obviously, the Medrash does not explain why that Parsha. Yeah, there had to be some fulfillment, especially since this is B'davke Parsha before the Chet HaEgel. If anything, one might have thought he should be erased after the Chet HaEgel. So the emes is, there's a word from the Vilna Gaon that says that Parshas Tetzaveh always falls the same week as Zion Adar, which is the day that Moshe Rabbeinu died. Right, Zayin Adar was earlier last week, and therefore Hashem is meramez that this is the week that Moshe Rabbeinu will be ne'elam, that he will not be here. This is the week of his patira. So first of all, keep in mind that obviously the Vilna Gaon's vort is only true like the Babylonian cycle of Torah reading that we follow, in which the Torah is read in a 1 year cycle. So on a non-leap year at least, Parshas Tetzaveh is always the week of Zion Adar. Remember that the old minhag of Eretz Yisrael was to read the Torah in 3 years, so obviously there was no particular correspondence. If you didn't finish the Torah every year, you didn't always have Parshas Tetzaveh with Zion Adar. By the way, the Reform movement, Lahavdil, many Havdalos, tries to emulate the old Eretz Yisrael minhag by reading, they only read one third of a parsha every week, but that's not the Eretz Yisrael minhag actually. Because in Eretz Yisrael, let's say Bereishis, if Parshas Bereishis was read over 3 weeks, so they would read one third of Bereishis, and then the second week they would read the second third of Bereishis. In other words, they would go straight; they wouldn't skip. The Reform custom, I believe, is they read one third of Bereishis, then next week they read one third of Noach, then next week they read, you know, one third of Lech Lecha. Right, they don't do it that way. Of course, since most of the Balei Kriya are women, maybe the women don't have time to fully prepare. Okay, but be it as it may, the Vilna Gaon's vort is only true like the Babylonian cycle. So it's a little daichik to say HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu built this structure in based on the Babylonian cycle. But the other point to keep in mind, and this is where I want to bring in Rav Yonis and Apshitz, is that in a leap year, this correlation isn't true. Because Rav Yonis and Apshitz wants to prove that Moshe Rabbeinu died, the year that Moshe Rabbeinu died was a leap year, and Moshe Rabbeinu died in Adar Beis. Now, why there would be leap years in the Midbar is not entirely clear, but he says that there were leap years even in the Midbar, because if Pesach got too early, they did observe Pesach even in the Midbar. But again, it's not so pushit, because in reality, at least for the Korban Pesach, we know that the Dor HaMidbar only brought two Korban Pesach. One was the Korban Pesach in Mitzrayim, you know, the night before, the day before Yitzhiya. And the other was the next year they brought a Korban Pesach, that is in Parshas Baloscha. But for the remainder of the 40 years in the desert, there actually was no Korban Pesach that they brought. And there's a machlokas exactly why didn't they bring a Korban Pesach the rest of the 40 years. One opinion is they should have, but as the Pasuk says in Yoshua, they did not practice bris milah on the newly born children, because after the Chet HaMeraglim, they were not so protected, and therefore it would be dangerous for them to do a bris milah. And the Torah says what? That if you have children, even, that don't have a bris milah, you're not allowed to bring the Korban Pesach. Now, that's a little bit of a difficult reason, because that would presuppose, I mean, if nobody brought the Korban Pesach, that would presuppose that every single family had boys that were uncircumcised, etc. Because even if there'd be one family that didn't, they would bring the Korban Pesach. But there's another reason. Rav Elyahu Mizrachi, the famous Parshan on Rashi, says that actually, in reality, very strangely enough, the Korban Pesach is mitzvah teluya bi'aretz. The Torah says, ki savo elo aretz. So the fact that they brought a Korban Pesach at all in the Midbar was a deviation. It was a horaz shah. It was a special one-time mitzvah. The permanent mitzvah of Korban Pesach, unlike the Korban Tamid, for example, is makushar to Eretz Yisrael itself, because the Korban Pesach is thanking Hashem for Geula, and the Geula was not nishlam until they came to Eretz Yisrael. But be it as it may, just because they didn't keep Korban Pesach in the Midbar doesn't mean they didn't keep Pesach. Chag HaMatzos, they weren't allowed to eat chametz. There was an isser of Bal Yeroya, Bal Yematzei. So consequently, there would be a reason for leap years in the Midbar, because if Pesach has to be in the spring, so when Pesach gets too early, you have to have a leap year. So Rav Yenison Apshitz posits the following idea, and he brings some beautiful proofs for it. Rav Yenison Apshitz posits that Moshe Rabbeinu died in a leap year, and he died Adar Sheni. He did not die Adar Rishon. With this, he wants to be Miyashev, a very, very interesting kasha. We know that when Haman was drawing lots to see what is the best month to destroy the Jewish people, so he was very happy when the month that he came up with was the month of Adar, which is the 12th month, counting from Nisan. And the Gemara in Megillah explains, why was Haman happy when he got the month of Adar? Because Haman knew that Moshe Rabbeinu died on the 7th of Adar, and therefore Haman thought that Adar was a bad month for the Jewish people, because that is when they lost their Redeemer. But Haman made a mistake, because although Moshe Rabbeinu did die in the 7th of Adar, he was also born on the 7th of Adar, and therefore it's a time of Geula, a time of Yeshua, and therefore it was a good month, and it was an auspicious month for the Jewish people. Now the question is, if Haman is such a lamdan, Haman knows when Moshe Rabbeinu died, why wouldn't he know when Moshe Rabbeinu was born? After all, there was a strong tradition among the Jewish people, that this was a preserved tradition, that Moshe Rabbeinu was born the same day that he died, because tzaddikim complete their life in that way. Why would Haman be ignorant of that? So here is what Rav Yenison Apshitz wants to say. He wants to say that Haman knew, indeed, that Moshe was born on Zion Adar, and Moshe died on Zion Adar. But here is, so Haman is now a big lamdan. But here is the problem. Moshe Rabbeinu was also born on a leap year. Now, why they had leap years in Mitzrayim, that is a real question. This is before there was a Korban Pesach. That I don't really understand what the purpose of a leap year would be then, because, you know, there was no Pesach that you needed to adjust. But he wants to say, Moshe Rabbeinu was born Zion Adar Rishon, and Moshe Rabbeinu died Zion Adar Sheni. Haman looked at them as two different months, and when he came up with Adar, he came up with Adar Sheni. He wants to say the miracle of Purim itself happened in Adar Sheni, and therefore he said Adar Sheni is a bad month because Moshe died. Moshe was born in Adar, he was born Adar Rishon is a good month, but we came up with other Sheni. And the idea that the miracle of Purim happened on a leap year, that is already in the Talmud Yerushalmi. Right? We know there's a machlokas in the Gemara. In a leap year, when do you read Megillah? There is one opinion, which we of course don't paskin like, that you read Megillah in Adar Rishon because of the principle of Zerizim, Makdimim L'mitzvos. You always do a mitzvah at your first opportunity. There's another opinion that we, of course, paskin like, that we read Megillah and observe all the laws of Purim Adar Sheni, but the Bavli and the Yerushalmi have a machlokas, what's the reason? The Bavli says, the reason why we prefer Adar Sheni is we want to connect the Geula of Purim with the Geula of Pesach. And therefore, we want to be Masmich Geula LeGeula. But the Yerushalmi gives another reason. The Yerushalmi Taka says, because the miracle of Purim, the miracle of Purim, the saving of the Jewish people, happens on a leap year that was Adar Sheni. So that's the Yerushalmi. That's not Rav Yonis and Apshitz. But Rav Yonis and Apshitz wants to therefore reconstruct the idea that Moshe died in Adar Sheni. Moshe was born Adar Rishon. That is why Haman thought Adar Sheni was a good month to kill the Jewish people. But he didn't realize that although the Adar is split in two, it is under the same spiritual mazal, and therefore it's all a good time. Now he brings a raya to this idea that Moshe Rabbeinu was born in a leap year. And this is a very, very interesting raya. It's a raya from Gemara in Saita. The Gemara in Saita preserves a tradition from the Chachamim that Moshe Rabbeinu was found by, we say Batsia, but really it's Bitya Bas Paro. He was retrieved from the Nile on the 28th of Nisan. Now, we don't have any source in the Psukim for that, but Chazal have a Mesorah that the day that Moshe was retrieved was the 28th of Nisan. Now, the Kasha is, the Torah says specifically that Moshe Rabbeinu was concealed. Moshe Rabbeinu was kept for 3 months. In other words, he was born premature, and therefore Paro's soldiers did not suspect there was a baby for a few months, so they were able to hide Moshe Rabbeinu for 3 months until the Paro soldiers figured out there must have been a baby that was born, and that is why Yocheved or Miriam had to put Moshe Rabbeinu into the Nile. Now the kasha is, if the pasuk says Moshe was hidden for 3 months before he was put into the Nile, but Chazal say he was retrieved on the 28th of Nisan, and Moshe Rabbeinu was born on the 7th of Adar. From the 7th of Adar to the 28th of Nisan is only what, 7 weeks or six or seven weeks? How do you get 3 months? But Rav Yonis and Apshitz says, if you assume it was a leap year, so he was born Zion Adar Aleph. So Zion Adar Aleph to the 28th of Nisan is 2 months and 3 weeks. Close enough. We can work with approximations. That is almost 3 months. And Mimela, the Torah might not be precise. At least you're much closer to the idea of 3 months. So Mimela, this is what Genesis and Apshitz wants to say, which in a sense actually means, maybe I don't want to take away the joy today, in a sense, this takes away some of the simcha of Purim Katan, because Bedavka, the whole nace of Purim, happens in Adar Sheni specifically. It's like a yahrzeit. If a person has a yahrzeit in a regular Adar, so then when it's a leap year, it's a machlokas, does he observe the yahrzeit in Rishon? Does he observe the yahrzeit in Sheni? Does he observe the yahrzeit both times? Those both days have a connection to the yahrzeit. But if someone died in Adar Sheni, you only keep the yahrzeit in Adar Sheni. So in a sense, if the miracle of Purim would have happened in a Shana Peshuta, then I could say each Adar is connected to the miracle. If it Badafka happened Adar Sheni, that drains away a little bit of the Simcha of Adar Rishon, because nothing, you know, Adar Rishon has no direct connection. But nevertheless, it's good to be Mesameach, and 60 days of Simcha is a nice thing.
I think you said, if he has the yahrzeit in Adar Sheni, he only keeps Adar Sheni.
Absolutely.
In a regular Adar with...
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course. Of course. I meant to say in a leap year, he only... Yeah, yeah, no, you're 100% correct. If it's a regular Adar, he obviously has to keep in a regular Adar. And by the way, this is a little bit of a brain teaser. I guess you probably have either know this or heard this or figured it out. and that is because of leap years, it is shayach for a child that is younger to become bar mitzvah earlier than a child that is older. So for example, if the two kids were born in a leap year, and one child was born the 20th of Adar Rishon, and the other child was born the 5th of Adar Sheni, so he's 2 weeks later, and then 13 years later, it's a Shana Pshuta, so the kid that was born the 5th of Adar Sheni has his bar mitzvah the 5th of Adar, and the kid that was born the 20th of Adar Rishon will have it the 20th of Adar. So it's actually possible for the younger child to be bar mitzvah or bas mitzvah before the older child. Okay, now let me just mention, so it turns out that the way Rav Yonah Apshit structures this, again he goes through a lot of other complications, I'll give you one more twist that he puts here. Moshe Rabbeinu was born Adar Rishon, although why there were leap years before Pesach is hard to understand. Moshe Rabbeinu dies Adar Sheni. The miracle of Purim happened Adar Sheni, right? That's Rav Yonah Apshit's structure. And the last point is from the Yerushalmi itself. The last point is not his speculation. It is the actual Talmud Yerushalmi that the Nes of Purim happened on a leap year of Adar Sheni. Now he then wants to answer another question. Again, you see the Aris Tavash is an intricate structure. And that is the following. You know that Shabbos Mincha, on a day that we would say Tachanun during the week, so after the Amida, after Chazaras Hashatz, we talk about Tzidkas Chatzedek. We recite three psukim from Tehillim in which we accept and acknowledge the justice of the Almighty. That's called Sidur Kadin. And the Rishonim say that the reason we have a minhag of a Sidur Kadin on Shabbos Mincha is because three great tzaddikim passed away Shabbos afternoon at Mincha, and we kind of accept Hashem's judgment. It was Moshe Rabbeinu, and an earlier Yosef, and David, right? That they were nifter on Shabbos Mincha. That is why some people have a minhag, which we do not follow, that they do not learn to the Ramah. But the Ramah brings such a minhag. The Ramah brings a minhag of not learning Torah between Mincha and Maariv on Shabbos, based on the principle that when a great, great tzaddik dies, we, as a sign of our grief, we don't learn Torah. Now again, these are not minhagim we encourage today, in fact, for the following reason, that generally speaking, when you tell people not to learn Torah, it's not that they'll occupy themselves with Tehillim or something else, they'll occupy themselves with things that are much worse. In fact, the Aruch HaShulchan actually says that if he would have the power, he says he doesn't have the power, right? If he would have the power, he would permit learning on Tisha B'Av. Because now we say, oh, not allowed to learn. So people, you know, do other things. Certainly learning would have been better than those other things. But okay. So be it as it may, though, so it's Mekubal that Moshe Rabbeinu died Shabbos Mincha. Right? That's Mekubal. Now, here's our problem. Chazal teach us that on the last day of Moshe Rabbeinu's life, he wrote, this is really amazing, he wrote 13 Sifrei Torah on the last day of his life. One Sefer Torah went into the Aron HaKodesh with the Luchos. That actually was the official Sefer Torah. You know, they probably have it in Israel too, but in America they have the Bureau of Standards. I'm not sure if it still goes by that name, where they have the official inch, the official meter, we don't have the metric system. But it goes by a different name now. So, you know, everything's the official yard. So in the Kodesh HaKodashim, during the Bayis Rishon, the Sefer Torah of Moshe was the official Torah. And according to Halacha, if there was a discrepancy in Sifrei Torah, they were allowed, even not on Yom Kippur, I don't know how often they did it, to go into the Kodesh HaKodashim, take out the Torah, and check it. Now, we lost that Torah when the Aron HaKodesh was hidden before the Churban of the Bayis Rishon. So one Torah went into the Aron, or the Kodesh HaKodashim, and 12 Torahs, each one was given to a Shevet. He wrote 13 Sifrei Torah that same day. By the way, some want to say an interesting thought. You know, one of the rayos that the Torah is divine is the fact that it's been thousands of years since Matan Torah, and all Sifrei Torah are the same to an accuracy rate of 99.99. Very, very, very few discrepancies. But the question becomes, how could there be any discrepancies? Doesn't that indicate that something was wrong in the transmission process? So some want to suggest the following idea, that when Moshe Rabbeinu wrote Toros for each of the tribes, Al Pi Hashem, certain minor, small differences were introduced for mystical or Kabbalistic reasons, that this was the appropriate Torah for Shevet Reuven, to be tiny little bit different than Shevet Shimon, and therefore whatever differences exist are not distortions in transmission, but they represent original alternative versions that were tailor-made to the Shvatim. Now, we don't understand the significance of what those discrepancies are. Petsua Daka, is Daka with a hay or with an olive? We don't understand the differences. We don't have an interpretation of the differences. But some want to suggest that just like the Arizal said much later, that all of the Nuschaos HaTfila corresponded to the idea that in the Beis HaMikdash there were 13 gates in the courtyard, and therefore each Shevet had its gate, and if you didn't know your Shevet for whatever reason, you went into the 13th gate. So the Arizal said that each different Nusach is a remnant of the Nusach of each Shevet that had its own way of praying to Hashem, and the Nusach Ari claimed that his Nusach was the Shar HaKolel. It was the Nusach that if you didn't know your Shevet, and most of us don't know our Shevet, we could go in. Of course, what is Nusach Ari is a very, very difficult question. Chabad calls its Nusach Ari, but that's only one version of Nusach Ari. Every Nusach Sfarad Siddur today, whether it's the Nusach Sfarad of Hasidim, which is really an Ashkenaz variant, or whether it's a Dutta Mizrach, most of them are based on some version of Nusach Ari. So we really don't know exactly what is Nusach Ari, although there is a Siddur you can get for $194 that will give you a great historical background of this. I'm agonizing right now and looking at my bank account to see if I should get it. But as I say, Nusach Ari is a very, very complicated issue. What is Nusach Ari? But some want to suggest that that same type of analysis would be true for the differences in Sifrei Torah. But be it as it may, what's our kasha? If Moshe Rabbeinu died on Shabbos, how could he write 13 Sifrei Torah? This is a kasha that Tosfos asks in Maseches Menachos. And Tosfos gives a fascinating answer. Tosfos says, listen, how do you write 13 Sifrei Torah? It must have been a nes. This is called Hashpa'as Kulmas. Hashpas Komas literally means you make the pen swear to do your bidding. It's kind of like magic writing. So Tosfos says a chiddush lahalacha, I don't know if it's nogeil l'maisa, that any malacha that you do b'derech nisim is not prohibited on Shabbos. The Torah prohibits doing malacha b'derech hateva. If you could do a malacha by a supernatural process, that is not prohibited on Shabbos. And therefore, Moshe obviously wrote the Torahs supernaturally. Therefore, it was mutter. That is what Tosos in Menachos says. But Rav Yonah in Apshitz wants to say the following. He says, now he's adding yet another speculation to this whole cheshbon. Not only that Moshe died in the second Adar, but he says Moshe abdicated his leadership 1 month earlier. On the 7th of Adar Aleph, in other words, the last month of his life, he was in seclusion. Kind of a tragic situation. And when the Torah says they mourned Moshe for 30 days, it was not after his physical death. It is after, you might say, his spiritual death, when he no longer served the Jewish people as leader. Therefore, Rav Yonah Apshitz says, Moshe Rabbeinu's last act as a leader was writing those Torahs, and that occurred on the 7th of Adar Aleph. So yes, when he physically left the world, it was the Shabbos of Adar Sheni. But if you count back 30 days to the 7th of Adar Rishon, that would not be a Shabbos, right? Right. So therefore, as a result, he says that the Ksiva Sifrei Torah was in Adar Rishon 1 month before the Petira of Moshe Rabbeinu. Therefore, that was not on Shabbos. No, that's correct. It was a miracle. No. In other words, he's saying it was a miracle, but he's not accepting he's not accepting the halachic conclusion that what you do through miracles is not, you know, is not forbidden on Shabbos. So if any of you have miracle workers, or magic or whatever it is, assuming you're allowed to use it, so that's another question. That's a whole issue. Now the Torah prohibits magic, so is there a concept of a permissible, and yet we certainly find Tanoim, Amoraim, later Mekubalim, doing things that are miracles. One has to differentiate that from magic, which would be normally prohibited, and the like. Okay, so this was a bit of a digression on from Rav Yehuda Sinepshitz to say for Yaros Tavash. Yeah. The what? Which one? How do Chazal know? No. That you can figure out pretty much because it's really from the beginning of Yoshua. The Torah says, the end of Zeis HaBracha says, Moshe Rabbeinu died, they mourned for 30 days. Then Hashem tells Yoshua, Chazak v'yamatz, because in 3 days we are crossing the Yarden. And we cross the Yarden, it is recorded on the 10th of Nisan. That is a date in the book of Yoshua. So consequently, if we cross the Yarden 33 days after the death of Moshe, and that was the 10th of Nisan, that's a given date, so working backwards...
Where did they get the idea that he stopped functioning?
That's again, Rav Yonah Sinepshitz. I don't remember if he brings a proof, but he suggests it as a possibility. I don't think he has a clear raya for that. Again, it's a big chiddush to learn that this is keneged Chazal.
That one makes more sense.
Makes more sense.
Started to write by itself.
No, but that had to be. But otherwise, you still have a question. How do you write 13 Torahs in one day?
That's going to be a
problem unless you assume there was a miracle and the like. Okay. All right, so that was just for in honor of Purim Katan, I wanted to share with you a thought of the Yaros Tavash. But now let's go back. Our main topic that we began, now we're really going back to Pesach, and that is we were discussing the mitzvah d'oraisa of remembering and recounting, at least in abbreviated fashion, the Exodus every single day, both in the day and in the night. And this is based on the Pasuk, Laman Tiskor Es Yom Seischa Me'eretz Mitzrayim Kol Yemei Chayecha. Now you'll remember, of course, you'll know it from the Haggadah, but it's actually a Mishnah at the end of the first parak of Brachos, that there seems to be a machlokas if you mention Yetzias Mitzrayim at night or only in the daytime. Right, the Mishnah, now the issue is focusing not about the Seder. The Seder, of course, you make at night. Nobody is saying make a Seder during the day. But the issue is the following, right? We know that there's a mitzvah of reading Kriya Shema in the morning and in the evening. But Kriya Shema, at most, is only the first two parshios of Shema v'hayayim Shemoa. Parshas Vayomer is not part of Kriya Shema. It is really not part of Kriya Shema at all. But we say it because it has a number of important things. One important thing is the mitzvah of tzitzis, and tzitzis is a reminder of the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah. And the other thing that is important is it is a reminder of Hashem taking us out of Mitzrayim with the verse Ani Hashem Elokeichem Asher Hotzeisi Eschem Me'eretz Mitzrayim. Now, tzitzis as a mitzvah is only a mitzvah in the daytime. It is not a mitzvah at night. There is no mitzvah to wear tzitzis at night, at least according to the Rambam, that's how we paskin. And that is because the Torah describes the mitzvah of tzitzis as uri isem oso. You must be able to see the tzitzis, that means by natural light, and therefore at night, where without light you would not be able to see the tzitzis, you are not obligated in tzitzis. That is why if a person puts on a talis at night, they do not make a bracha, because there's no mitzvah at night. So on Yom Kippur, that's right, that's important. Yom Kippur, which is the one service in which men wear a talis into the night, one must make the bracha while it is still daylight before sunset. If you come in after Shkia, you do not make the bracha on the tzitzis. So the question becomes, therefore, if there is no mitzvah of tzitzis at night, then why do I say Vayomer at night? Why do I say the Parsha of Tzitzis at night? The answer is, the only reason why you say Vayomer at night is because you're fulfilling the mitzvah of Zechiras Yitzias Mitzrayim. Meaning in the daytime, there are at least, actually there's more than two, but there are at least two reasons why I say Vayomer. One is Parshas Tzitzis, which is a reminder of mitzvos, and the second is the mitzvah of Zechiras Yitzias Mitzrayim. At night, you don't have the mitzvah of Tzitzis, so the only reason you say Vayomer is because of Zechiras Yitzias Mitzrayim. Again, which is a separate mitzvah, I pointed out last week. It's not Kriya Shema. Even the trusty Art Scroll Sitter tells you, have intention when you say this verse to fulfill the mitzvah of remembering the Exodus verbally. Okay, that is why the Gemara in Brachos records, and this is in the Talmud Yerushalmi as well, as the old minog in Eretz Yisrael, very amazing, that they didn't even say the whole Parsha of Tzitzis. They just said, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe Lamor. They skipped everything and they said, Ani Hashem Elokeichem Asher Otseisi Eschem Eretz Mitzrayim. They skipped all of the intervening psukim about Tzitzis at night, because there was no mitzvah since his night. Now, we're only saying it because of Zechiras Yitzias Mitzrayim. They only said the first verse and the last verse. Of course, sometimes we dive in at Minyanim. I wonder if they still keep that old Eretz Yisrael Minog and the like. But okay.
Even in the morning.
That's right. Even in the morning, right. So here is the machlokas, though. There is a machlokas. Is there a mitzvah to mention the Exodus at night? Because after all, we didn't leave Mitzrayim until the daytime. And if there is no mitzvah to mention the Exodus at night, then you wouldn't say Vayomer at all. That's the machlokas in the Mishnah. So the Tanakhama says, Maskirin Yitzias Mitzrayim Balelos. That is the halacha. We are obligated to mention the Exodus even at night, because even though we didn't leave until the morning, the Geula began at night through the Makas Bechoros and the like. And that is why we say, what is the Mishnah saying? That is why we say Vayomer even at night, either the Babylonian way, the Mishnah doesn't address that, which is the whole Parsha of Tzitzis, or the original Eretz Yisrael way, which is only the Ani Hashem Elokeich. But then the Mishnah goes on, after it states that you do it at night, it then seems to give us a contrary view. And this is the famous statement that is quoted in the Haggadah, Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Hare ani kaven shivim shana. Behold, I am like a 70-year-old person. As you know, Chazal give us the story that there was a palace revolt, so to speak, against Rabban Gamliel, the head of the Sanhedrin, because he was humiliating Rabbi Yeshua a number of times in order to preserve unity, because Rabbi Yeshua did not accept certain decisions. And finally, the palace guard, so to speak, the students, the Talmidim, revolted, and they deposed him as the Nasi, and they appointed Rabbi, they didn't know who to appoint, really. Should they appoint Rabbi Yeshua, who was really the next in command? But that would have been too much of an insult. They didn't want to appoint other people because they weren't rich, and if you weren't rich, you couldn't negotiate with the Romans as political head. Rabbi Akiva was the greatest Talmud Chacham, but he didn't have a yichus. He came from a non-Jewish origin, and therefore he didn't have zechus avos. So they finally decided on what you call a dark horse candidate. This was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who was wealthy. He was a very, very great in learning and piety. He had yichus, he was a Kohen, and he was descended from Ezra HaKohen. But the problem was, he was a very young man. He was only 18 years old. To make an 18-year-old the head of the Sanhedrin is a very, very tough position. So he goes to his wife, he discusses it with his wife, and his wife says, you know, they'll take it away from you like they took it away from Rabbi Gamliel. What do you want this Torah? And he said, if you could have a precious cup for even one day, it's worthwhile to have it, even if it's going to get broken. Now, this doesn't mean like he just wants the gaiva of a nice position, but he felt that he could do something l'shem shemayim, but he didn't look old, and people might not respect him. So there was a miracle that his beard turned white or gray, and as a result he says, I am like a man that is 70 years old. Some want to say, well, maybe it wasn't just a miracle when he had this awesome responsibility. He turned gray. You know, my wife likes to remind me that a lot of my chaverim in Shiva who didn't go into Rabbanah still have dark beards. You know, so there may be something to that, and the like. Now, the Gemara goes on. It's a fascinating story on so many levels. Like, why was Rabbi Gamliel behaving this way? But it mentions that Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria instituted a whole bunch of new policies. He was very aggressive in changing things. That Rabbi Gamliel was very selective who could come to the yeshiva to learn. He only accepted people who were just as good on the inside as on the outside, meaning they have to have character and midos and very, very difficult admission standards. Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria had open admissions. Anybody who wants to come, let him learn. No conditions, no prerequisites. And the Gemara says, the day that Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria became the Nasi, they had to add 400 benches in the Beis HaMedrash. And Rabbi Gamliel saw all of this. And he was very, very distraught, not because of God, but the other way around. He says, do you mean I prevented so many people from learning Torah? Was I wrong? So the Gemara says, Hashem gave him a dream that first night of a bunch of beautiful white ceramic jars that looked so beautiful and pretty, like flower pots. And they were just filled with dirt. As if to tell him, don't worry about it, these people look good, but they're no good. Meaning, you were right. But then the Gemara says in surprise, but not really. Hashem just didn't want him to feel too bad. Which means he was wrong. And again, that itself is such a fascinating issue. You know, these types of Gemaras are very, very contemporary. You know, to this very day, we struggle with the idea of exclusive admission standards. It's a big issue. That, you know, I want my son to go to the genius, the Eloi yeshiva. Or the yeshiva where nobody works, or the yeshiva, you know, whatever it might be. And people are making, you know, they refuse to have schools that are more open-based and more inclusive. Maybe you heard this of Shlomo Rechnitz, who's a very well-known philanthropist, actually, son-in-law of Rav Belsky, Zichrono Livracha, made a whole speech in Lakewood against this. Of course, he apologized afterwards. He didn't want it to get all that publicity, but about the notion of exclusiveness and how it can reflect gaiva. And I saw myself, a short video of Rav Steinman. Some people came to Rav Steinman. They ran a cheder. And they said, you know, there's a woman, I mean, she's from, but you know, she's sending her, wants to send her child to the cheder, but she's not quite as from as the other people in the cheder. So the other people in the cheder don't want, you know, her child there. They feel it would be a bad influence. He blew up. It was unbelievable. Rav Steinman is the most mild-mannered of people. Rav Steinman. But he started screaming. And he started saying, this is gaiva, this is gazanut, it's racism. He says, he grew up in Brisk, and the Brisk Rav went to a cheder with people who didn't keep Shabbat. You know, there wasn't the concept of, you have to have a separate school all the time. And then the people of the cheder said, but these are real B'nai Torah who are against this. He says, they're not B'nai Torah, they're just Bali Gaiva. He says, they think they're chashuv. He says, this is fake. And then he started saying, where should she go? Send your child to the moon? We don't have schools in the moon. And he said, so the truth is, everything Rechnitz said, Rav Steinman said, and in a stronger tone. So it's so fascinating. But it mentions like the following. But be it as it may, this is why it says, I am like a man of 70. And the Arizal adds a Kabbalistic twist, a fascinating Kabbalistic twist. We know that the Arizal was very much into the concept of the reincarnation of neshamas, Gilgal. It's not mentioned in the Gemara, but the Mekubalim did very much teach the idea of Gilgal neshamas. It is mentioned in the Ramban. The Ramban has a perish on Sefer Iyuv, and the Ramban talks about Gilgal as well. So the Arizal says, again, Ruach HaKodesh, we don't know how the Arizal knew this, that Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria was a Gilgal of Shmuel Hanavi. Now think about this. Shmuel Hanavi, who is as great as Moshe and Aaron, died tragically young. Shmuel Hanavi died at 52 years old. And we know this, Chazal say, because Chana kept Shmuel until he was weaned, and that was typically 2 years. And then she said, I will give him to Hashem service ad olam, forever. And we know ad olam always refers to yovel. A yovel of years is called olam, which is 50 years. So the 2 years of weaning plus the yovel is 52. So if Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was a reincarnation of Shmuel HaNavi, the soul that he was given at birth was a soul that had already sojourned in the earth for 52 years. So when he was 18 years old, 52 plus 18 is 70, behold, I have the soul of a 70-year-old man. This is what the Arizal says. Hare ani kaven shivim sham. Okay, let's go on with the sentence. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, behold, I am like a person that is 70 years old. V'lo zachisi sheteyamar yitzias Mitzrayim balelos. Now, this is actually a difficult phrase to translate. I didn't merit that the exodus of Egypt would be said even at night. Ad shedarsha ben Zoma, till ben Zoma made a drasha. And the drasha is that the Torah said, you shall remember the exodus all the days of your life. Call. The word call is an extra word. Just say every day. Yemei chayecha. The answer, if it would have said the days, that might have meant the days. The extra word, all the days, means the night. Now there's another view of the Chachamim. I'm going to have to say that for next week. I don't want to bring up too many different things. But let's look at, what is Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah saying? Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is saying, I didn't merit that the Exodus should be said at night until Ben Zoma made a drasha that were marba. Now you see clearly from the drasha that the default position would have been only in the daytime. And what would you have said without a special drasha? Only the day. Why only the day? Because we left during the day. You need what is called a riboy, extra word, extra teaching, to include night, and that extra word is the superfluous word call. Now, when Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, I didn't merit until Ben Zoma had a drasha, there are two interpretations in the commentaries what Ben Zoma is saying. The simplest meaning, which is paradoxically not what the way Rashi learns, is he himself didn't know the halacha. Meaning, what he's saying is, I myself only did it in the day because I wasn't aware of this law until Ben Zoma, who is a great chacham, taught us. Now that would make sense. He didn't know and Ben Zoma taught him. But that's not what Rashi says. And again, you can check your Haggadah translations for how they translate it. Rashi says, lo zachisi means lo nitzachti lechachamim. I could not convince the sages. I was doing it at night. I was always doing it at night. But even though I became nasi, I could not convince the sages that they should do it at night until Ben Zoma had his drasha. That's what Rashi says. Lo zachisi sheteyamer. See, it doesn't say lo zachisi shamarti. I did not merit to get other people to do it. Now, the big question on Rashi is the following. If Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was not aware of Ben Zoma's drasha, which is why he couldn't convince the Chachamim, then why was he doing it? In other words, the way Rashi understands the Mishnah, contextually, he must have had some other source, which is why he did it. So number one, what is that other source? Not given. Number two, if he had another source, why was that not persuasive? You see the kind. In other words, if you learn the Mishnah the other way, that he's literally saying, I myself didn't know, so everything is fine. I didn't know. Ben Zoma gave us a makor, so now I know. But if I learn, I was already doing it, but I couldn't convince other people, and Ben Zoma came and convinced other people, well, so why were you doing it? And if you had a reason, well, if you didn't have a reason, then why? And if you had a reason, why wasn't your reason good enough for them? Right? So a very, even a simple line that we say in the Haggadah every year, and it's a Mishnah Maseches Brachos, it's not so easy to understand. Of course, another question I'll raise, which is really a Haggadah question, and that is, what is that even doing in the Haggadah? Because remember the following. There is indeed a machlokas. I was debating about taking a coat. I guess I decided wrong today. But okay. Yeah. Anyway. There is indeed a machlokas. Is there a mitzvah of zechira at night? Ben Zoma says yes. And there's a chachamim in there that says no. But keep in mind that is a machlokas about the whole year. Do you say Parshat Sitzes at night? And that is a machlokas. Do I say that the redemption was in the day, so I only do it in the day? Or do I say Makas Bechoros is the beginning of the redemption, so I do it at night? That's a machlokas. So if you ask a person, why am I reading this? Well, so somebody might say, well, you know, we're doing the Seder at night, so we need to establish that you do a Seder at night. That Mishnah has nothing to do with that. What? The ones that say you only mention the Exodus in the day, they're going to say you only make a Seder in the day? Of course not. The Seder is a reenactment of the eating of the Korban Pesach in Mitzrayim. So, it's going to be at night no matter what your position is about the rest of the year. So there's a whole kasha, right? That's a kasha on the Haggadah. You can discuss this at the Seder. And that is, why does the Haggadah discuss the parameters of the mitzvah of Zechira if the mitzvah of Zechira has no connection to the annual mitzvah of Sipur? The annual mitzvah of Sipur is at night l'chulium. So let me give you a very short answer on that. And this is an answer, a lot of Mefarshim say it, but the Nitziv says it in a relatively simple way. The Haggadah is trying to prove, right, at the end of the paragraph of Avadim Hayinu, it makes the point that even if we are Chachamim, even if we're Nevonim, no matter how knowledgeable we are, no matter how experienced we are, no matter how learned we are, we have to recount this story. Then it adds, Kol HaMarbe L'Saper B'Yetziat Mitzrayim Hare Zem Mishubach. That there is a concept of marbe, meaning you could be yotze maybe with a short story, but the more you are ma'arich in the details, even beyond the Haggadah, that is praiseworthy. One should be marbe in the, and that's why it brings the story about the Seder of Rabbi Akiva and Bnei Brak, that they were sitting the whole night. They were chachamim, they were nevonim, they knew the Torah, and they did it the whole night until it was time for the morning of Shema. So here's what the Nitziv says. Again, it's a little bit of a pill, but it makes a lot of sense. He says the following. How do Chazal know that it's praiseworthy to be marbeh? Maybe I do my minimum and that's fine. Who says? I mean, there are mitzvahs where it's not praiseworthy. For example, matzah. You have to eat a kezias of matzah. Now, good, we don't know what a kezias is, so we eat a lot of matzah. But let's say you ate a kezias. We wouldn't say it's praiseworthy to eat more. Right? I did the mitzvah. You daven three times a day. We normally say it's not praiseworthy to daven more than that. So the raya is the following. Behechrech, the Torah is telling me, it's better to do more. Because even without Sipur, there would have been a mitzvah of mentioning the Exodus anyway. In other words, like this. What is the Torah adding by telling me I have to narrate the Exodus, Pesach night, if I have to mention the Exodus anyway? So, if I learned there would be no mitzvah of Zechira at night, then maybe once a year, the only thing the Torah is telling me is that which you do every day in the daytime, do it at night. So then I wouldn't know that you have to be marbeh. Maybe all the Torah is doing is making the mitzvah of zechira that is biyom and making it for that one night. But if I know zechira is at night every night, then what is the Torah telling me with Sipur? It can't be telling me just mention the Exodus, because I have to do that anyway. It must be telling me be marbe in the Sipur. And therefore, the Netziv says, by establishing that there's a minimalist mitzvah of zechira kol yemot hashana, you get an insight into the definition of Sipur. Sipur becomes kol hamarbe because there's already zechira. Masha Einken, if there wouldn't be zechira at night, then one could have thought the mitzvah of Sipur is simply telling me do this zechira one night a year. Right. So therefore, the Netziv says that the need to establish halachically that we're mazkir every single night is a proof to kol hamarbeh hareza meshubach. This is what the Netziv says. By the way, again, as an aside, and forgive me for bringing digressions, but when something comes to me, I'd like to share it with you. You know, the Netziv, of course, now the Rav Natoli Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, was the Rosh Yeshiva of the world-famous Volozhiner Yeshiva for over 50 years. And it was in his lifetime that the Russian government closed down the Volozhiner Yeshiva, which was a great tragedy in Klal Yisrael at the time. They closed it down. Again, it's a whole interesting story. Why they closed it down? The official yeshivish account is because the Russian government insisted that they introduce secular studies, and the Netziv said, I'm going to close down the yeshiva rather than introduce secular studies. And that is used as a precedent, Bizman Hazeh, for opposition to secular studies. Now, the Netziv had a nephew who was a Talmud of Volozhin, who actually was also the Netziv's secretary as well, and that was the Torah Tamima, Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein, and he gave a different account. He wrote a fascinating four-volume reminiscence called Makor Baruch, in which he says the problem was not secular studies. The Netziv was not against secular studies, and the Netziv was willing to allow a certain amount of secular studies, but the Russian government basically wanted secular studies 5 hours in the afternoon, and the yeshiva had to be closed at night for allegedly health reasons. And therefore, the learning would have been 2 hours a day. And that was not shayach, that was not a yeshiva already. But the Netziv was not against the idea of some secular limudei chol, as long as there would be 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day of learning. Now, sounds okay, you know, sounds reasonable. But I remember many, many years ago, Art Scroll, somebody translated that volume of Makor Baruch, and the Lakewood Cheder sent it out for fundraising. And then, you know, a book, you know, get a book, you know. I don't know if they do it in Eretz Yisrael, but in America it's very common. They yeshivas send books or svarim as part of the fundraising. So then around, you know, most people don't, you know, you get a book, you don't necessarily read it. A few weeks later, we get a letter from the Lakewood Cheder asking us to return the book, and we will get a full refund because the book does not reflect Torah true philosophies. Now, you can rest assured that absolutely every person who got that letter is going to read the book with a fine-tooth comb to try to figure out what is the problem here. But it turned out the problem was that the Torah Tamima seems to be suggesting that the Netziv had no problem with a secular studies program in the yeshiva as long as it was in moderation and did not significantly interfere with the Limudei Kodesh. And the only problem was that the Russian government essentially was obliterating the entire thing. And they thought that that was not the officially sanctioned account, and therefore they asked for a return of the book, and they would send you back your money. But be it as it may, I don't want to get too political, but as you know, I mean, these issues are live issues, and it's interesting how history has a lot of interesting things to say. Well, in Hebrew, it's called My Uncle the Netziv. Okay, so check it out why Volozhin was closed, and then know that that's a very controversial story. Okay, but anyway, the reason I'm mentioning the Nitziv, though, because of the following. That the Nitziv had used to, when he would make his Seder, he would invite the whole yeshiva to come to his Seder. And it is brought down. Now, the legend was not like Mir. The legend of yeshiva at its height had 500 bachurim, but these were Eloyim. These were like the elite. Volozhin was a very elitist yeshiva. An average boy did not go to Volozhin. There were other places he would go to. Volozhin was the training ground for Gedolim and Rosh Hashivas and the like. But it is brought down that almost no boy went home for Bein Hazman and Pesach. Everyone just yearned to stay at the Nitziv Sedarim. And it was such a magnificent, beautiful, beautiful experience. People talked, they did go the whole night, both Sedarim in Chutz La'aretz. And it is brought down. One of the things is that every boy, I don't know if every year you got it, got also a gift from the Nitziv. The Nitziv wrote a very beautiful parish on the Haggadah, and every person would get his own autographed, you know, Haggadah from the Nitziv as well. So although you can't really buy an autographed copy unless you have a lot of money, but the Nitziv's parish is still a very, very beautiful parish. But both the Torah Tamima and the Nitziv's youngest son, Rav Meir Bar Ilan, Rav Meir Berlin, Rav Meir, the Nitziv's younger son, say, as beautiful as the written Sefer is, it is only a fraction of what it was like to hear the Divrei Torah from the Nitziv himself. And in fact, you know, the Nitziv's co-Rosh Yeshiva was initially the Beis Halevi, Rav Yosef Do Soloveitchik, and later Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. And the Nitziv once said, as a bit of a joke, the difference between the Beis Halevi Seder, yeah, it's a little sarcastic, but the difference between the Beis Halevi Seder and the Nitziv Seder, the Beis Halevi, which is brisk, had such a Yiras Shemayim. So the Beis Halevi is agonizing. You know, is the matzah kosher? Is there chametz here? He says Pesach is miserable for him. He says he suffers every single second of Pesach. And in fact, Brishkas used to say when Pesach was over, they actually said to us, Baruch Hashem, we survived. We survived the Pesach without a chet. And the Siv says, is that chayrus? You're not going from Avdus to Cheres, you're going from Cheres to Avdus. He says, the Beis Halevi, he says, is a reverse Pesach. He's going into slavery with all of this worry and all of this pachat. He says, Nitziv says, no, a person has to have simcha. You have to take care of the halachas, to be sure. But then you should have a sense of menucha, a sense of repose, a sense of liberation, a sense of simcha. That is what Pesach is ultimately about. Zman Cheruseinu, a Cherus of feeling the presence and the love of Hashem. So he says he doesn't know if the Beis Levi really can enjoy Pesach because he's so worried about all of the Yisurim. That's what they say when they say Purim Sameach and Chag Kosher for Pesach. So they say the other way around. For Purim, you know, there's all sorts of shilas with Shalach Manas, so you should wish people a kosher Purim. A happy Purim for sure they'll have. You don't have to say have a happy Purim. A kosher Purim. For Pesach, for sure, you know, we have a kosher Pesach, we're very meticulous, but be sure to have a happy Pesach. So you should wish people a happy Pesach and a kosher Purim instead of kind of reversing it. Okay, we'll continue next week. Take care.